My name is Bonnie Nash, and I'm doing a session on loss and grief. You must really be interested to come out this late. What I would like to go over tonight a little bit and see if this sounds like it's of interest to you. I'd like to talk about kind of generally all the losses that we experience in life, and then more specifically concentrate on the bereavement process. And then the healing that can happen in that, and how we can be healers for each other, and that is a lot of stuff. And in the midst of all of that, I sure would like some of your feedback too. And I also don't want to go past 9:30. So if this interests you, if you have a need to talk about this further after the session or later on this week, please feel free to do that. But I want to keep it under an hour. So, is that of interest? Okay. My reason for being so interested in this subject is because when I was in Hong Kong, I lost a little 12-year-old friend. She died suddenly, accidentally, of carbon monoxide poisoning because of a faulty hot water heater. And that whole experience helped me trying to help her parents through that, and I didn't know anything about grief myself. And then kind of ignoring my own feelings in that whole situation, and then feeling later like I was going crazy and wondering what on earth was wrong with me, because I had never felt such acute anxiety as I felt during that period. Going to a pastor in Hong Kong and finding actually that I felt worse after I had gone to visit him than I had entering his office. Wondering about God and suffering, and which eventually got me into seminary. And then, thank God, I had Herb Anderson as a teacher who has written books on loss and grief. And then by taking classes from him and then doing a year of CPE and so on and studying more and more on loss and grief and then doing a year with hospice with dying people, I learned that what I had experienced was simply normal grief, and I wish somebody would have told me that right at the beginning. So I sort of had a passion for this. Then getting out of seminary and not being able to, not wanting to get into the parish, so creating my own job, and I thought it would really be good to have a chaplain in funeral homes. And so that's what I created and proposed, and the person that I proposed it to was willing to take that on, and so I essentially became a chaplain in a funeral home connected to a church. And what this was doing a lot of bereavement counseling, and basically that's what I've been doing for the last 2.5 years. So I've seen lots and lots of grief. I think what is real interesting for me to realize, especially as I get older and older, is that when we experience grief, it is not just through grief because of death, losing a loved one through death, but I think our whole life is constantly full of changes, and with change comes loss, and with loss comes grief. And this is the natural pattern of life. And as I look at life and all of the changes that take place, I've sort of got this broken down into 4 major kinds of losses that we experience. And I hope that this will be helpful for you in your understanding of your life as well. Developmental loss is kind of the first one, and this is what happens to us normally and naturally as we live through life, for example, if you think about a child being born, the very first day of our life is probably one of the most traumatic losses that we've ever gone through, because, you know, you're in your mother's womb, you're soft, warm, you're fed automatically. All of your needs are met, and suddenly you're broken away from her, you're squished through this little canal, and you burst out into this bright light, and your needs aren't automatically met anymore. You have to cry to get them met. So first loss, first major loss is the first day of our life outside of the womb. Think of the three-year-old that has a pacifier and a teddy bear and a blanket and wants to go off to nursery school, and her mom says, you can't take the pacifier to nursery school because kids will laugh at you, and so she has to leave the pacifier at home. You know, a second kind of loss. The losses that happen as we continue to grow as children. For any of you that have teenagers, you know, they're trying to play different roles, and you're trying to figure out what your role is with them now. They're trying to be responsible, but sometimes come out being irresponsible, and they want to be adult and make decisions, but sometimes can't. You want to be a parent, but yet you want to give them your freedom. These things are changes, and they, you know, include losses. And then they leave the nest. You remember yourself when you left your home to go into college or work or whatever. It was a whole new way of life. You left friends behind. You left your parents. A whole new relationship begins to develop from your parents that you knew at home to the parents that you go back now to visit. Then you decide to have a partner or to get married or whatever. And even though you fall in love, and that's a wonderful thing, still with that comes some losses of freedom. Then maybe you decide to get married and you have some children with children. I mean, that's a wonderful gain and a wonderful blessing, but along with that, my sister tells me, who's just had two small children, come a lot of losses. You know, loss of her sleep, for one thing. I mean, she's up every every hour on the hour. And so on, and then your children leave the nest, and more losses, and then you grow older, and you lose your hair, and you lose your sight, and you lose your hearing. And then I think of some of my old friends in the nursing home who lose their independence, lose their driver's license, sometimes lose their home, have to, and along with that comes losing their furniture, comes losing their favorite pet poodle as they're put into the nursing home. Many, many losses. Those are developmental losses. The second kind of loss I think that we go through in our life is material, and this might not seem real significant for those of us that aren't materialistic at all. But along with this, and I don't, Jan might get mad at me about this, but sometimes we have pets in this category. But I also want to put pets in with relationships, which I'll mention later. But material loss, it's okay, perhaps, if someone steals your bicycle. And even, I know some wonderful folks from Starbuck, Minnesota, and their house burned down 30 years ago, and the loss of the house wasn't so bad, but what they talk about are the loss of those photographs, which carried so much meaning for them. Or if someone that you have loved has given you something, even though it's not worth a lot, but you may misplace it, like a ring, or just a cheap little necklace, or a picture that your grandmother gave you, and now you've misplaced it. Those are significant material losses because of the sentimental value that you place with them. The third kind of loss is loss of self. Kind of goes along with the developmental. And the way I can best illustrate this is to think, if you think of yourself as a big apple pie, for example, and, you know, we are real complex people, and we are made up of many different pieces, and those pieces can go on and on and on. What pieces make you up? Let's just fill in these blanks. Who are you? What makes you up?
Okay.
Young woman.
Someone's child to begin with.
Okay, so you are related to someone, relationships.
What else makes you up?
Occupation.
Your occupation, okay.
Interests.
Your interests, okay.
Your faith.
Your faith.
Physical being.
Okay, your body. Emotions.
Emotions. Dreams, those are real significant, I think. The dreams that you have. Okay, these are all good. All these things make up you. Now, as we go through life, we lose these things, but we also gain. But I'm not here to talk about gains tonight. I'm here to talk about losses. So. But we lose these things, and these things change. For example, think of your body. Think of your body 10 years ago. Is it different from how it is now? When I skied down the road 13 years ago, I did it much faster than I did it today. Our bodies change, of course. Think about how you think about God now. Is it different than it was when you were age 6, for example? Of course. And hopefully it will be different 10 years from now. Hopefully this process of faith continues to grow and change and bloom. Our bodies will be different also 10 years from now, of course. Think about the dreams that you have. Have you lost any dreams in the past? I have. I'm sure that you have too. And those change, and then as we lose some, then we think, well, okay, but I can have a new dream. I can have a new goal. And some of those change. So these things, our interests can also change, and our emotions can change from minute to minute, at least mine can. So these things are constantly changing, and we lose a part of them. Kind of a real harsh example that I use for this is when I was working as a chaplain in a hospital in Minneapolis, one night I was on call, and there was a young boy about 16 who was flown in. We had a helicopter service for emergencies. He was flown in from a farm up north because his arms had been pulled off in a silo unloader. And he was flown in to get his arms reattached to his body. And the doctors were not able to do it. And so anyway, after about 6 weeks, he left the hospital and he was without his arms. So this boy lost a real big chunk of his body. I mean, a real significant part. Now, if we had, we'll use interest for that. Think of a 16-year-old boy trying to date, without his arms. Think about how his relationships would change. I'm sure significantly. Until people got used to that. And I don't know what that would be like to be a 16-year-old boy in school without arms. I called his mom about 2 months after that, and he had gotten artificial limbs. And she said that he was able to drive the tractor, but he was not able to do minute things like zip up his pants and feed himself. He lost, if I had dignity up here, I would erase that. He lost a great deal of dignity, at least for the time being. He always wanted to be a farmer. And they said now that he didn't have arms, he was going to have to learn how to use the computer with a stick. And he said, why don't you learn how to use the computer with a stick? He didn't want to do that. He wanted to be a farmer. So he lost his dreams. He was real angry at God, understandably so. And his emotions, I'm sure, changed. So this whole boy that we had, he had big chunks of him taken away just within, a few hours. And, you know, for yourself, it's not that traumatic, I suppose, but think about your own losses of yourself that you have gone through in your life. Dreams that you may have had that are lost. The faith journey that you have been on, it changes. And then the last one I see is major losses. Loss in relationships. Which, of course, is very significant. And, for example, divorce. Or I have some old friends who have lost their spouse to Alzheimer's disease. Or I have some friends who continue to stay married, although their relationship is dead. They don't really love each other anymore. Loss of relationship. Think about how many times you have moved in your life. You know, I've moved so many times. And I think Holden people are still not all in the same personality category. And I suspect you probably have moved many times in your life too. Think about the people that you have missed then from your church, you know, from your schools, from your hometown. One of the things that writing Christmas cards does for me is that I get, I start remembering these people, and I go through a little grief process every time I write Christmas cards because I think about how much I have loved them and how much I still miss them. Loss of relationships. And then the ultimate loss in relationship is that of death. So before I go on, do you have any comments or thoughts on this? And then what I want to say is that this all can develop grief. You know, if you wake up one day and feel a little depressed and you can't really figure out why, some of this might be part of that.
There's something I'd add under developmental, and I don't know, maybe it was inherent in what you said already, but a six-year-old child that you know today isn't the three-year-old child you knew 3 years ago. And you've lost that three-year-old child.
That's right. How else does this fit for you? Can you think of material losses that you've experienced that have been real significant? Or parts of yourself that you've lost?
I was traveling last winter and it was a significant day because the following day we were going to be going up into on this 5-day hike in the mountains and beautiful panoramic views and all this. And that day before, I lost my camera. And I thought, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought at that time, boy, you know, this has really become a material possession of mine that I valued highly. And I went, you know, we called the police, we went here and there, and I was wondering, should I buy a new camera? Should I borrow it? What should I do? Should I call my insurance company tonight or tomorrow? How soon do you have to do claims? And it ended up the next day it was turned in, so I didn't have to deal with it then, but that was a significant material.
Good example.
Bonnie?
Yes?
Every time I move, I feel that I lose the environment that I was in.
Yes.
I've lost the view out the back window or the land, mm-hmm. where the sky is or the clouds move in that particular part of the country. I miss parts of that. I don't know if that's material or not.
Did you find that when you go back to those places that it's the same for you, or does it seem different?
It seems the same as far as the environment goes.
good. There is some security in that then. I mean, at thinking about coming back to Holden too, I mean, Dumbbell or whatever we call that mountain now, I mean, it's always that beautiful, you know. It's some things aren't going to change, at least for a while. The beauty of that environment.
I found in moving around too that my identity changed, and that could be a significant loss. Mm-hmm. You left a community where you had an established identity and went to another one.
Yes.
It could change radically.
Good example, yeah.
When you retire, you lose that occupational identity that you had.
This might fall under loss of self, but I have a picture that I brought to school. I don't take many pictures, and the ones that I do are usually mean something to me. And this is a picture that a friend of mine take when we were out at Heavenly Valley. And I really wanted to get a picture of myself going off it was just a huge jump. I mean, I couldn't believe that I did it, and I really hurt myself. Anyway, but we got the picture.
and we know the rest of the story.
and it's something that I always thought, this is something that was something, as you know, kind of proud of for one thing. It's something I'd like to show. You know, have around to show, you know, maybe my kids, or, you know, when I get older, when people couldn't imagine me ever doing something like that, and I lost that school.
Another good example. Really, it was real valuable for you. Maybe you could do it again, Peter.
And one of my favorite things about going on trips is taking pictures and then coming back and then reliving the trip when I get back and showing it to all my friends. And I went on a 2-week trip to England in May and took 3 rolls of pictures, and the whole time just imagining the thrilled looks on the faces of my friends, and I showed them, and I got my film back when I got back, and they were all blank because my camera had been broken. And I just felt sick, and I felt like I had just lost, you know, half of my trip because I couldn't relive it through the pictures. Mm.
I think we need a workshop just on photographs.
Marie and I will lead it.
I had a security blanket, just like Linus, you know, when I was a little kid. My mother told me later she was afraid I was going to take it to college with me. But I really hung on to it. And I don't remember I guess I must have lost it, or my parents, you know, took it away or something. But every now and then when I'm kind of sleepy and I have a blanket near me, I can almost remember that feeling, you know. It's good there's other blankets in the room. That one was special.
I think one of the most significant losses for me is, which I think would be a material loss, is the loss of a piece of land on my grandmother's farm. Which was a place where I spent a lot of childhood hours, and my family spent a lot of time together, and it's been sort of bulldozed. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was always kind of a sacred place. Mm-hmm. I considered it kind of holy ground, and it's gone, and I can't go back, and I can't go back and relive those childhood memories anymore without. I can go back, but it's not the same, and all I feel when I go there is pain, and that's really hard.
As I've gotten older, I've started, you know, to lose, you know, certain functions, you know, mental and physical. But as you think back, you realize, you know, the losses that you have. But the aging process, you know, kind of has a natural way of allowing you to accept that. But at the same time, I've lost some functions through, you know, immediate. Physical losses through illnesses or whatnot, where you had that today and now it's gone, and you get an immediate feedback as to, I could do it yesterday, I can't do it today, and I probably won't do it again, And also my recuperative powers are now much less than they were before, harder to adapt. And the suddenness of the onset of losses like that make it much more evident.
Good examples. And, you know, I think a real significant loss for all of us, too, are those pets. I think of a series of pets that I have abandoned or have died, and real significant relationships that they have been for me. Well, we could spend another hour on this, but we need to move on. So, now, in the kind of bereavement that I want to talk about is the feelings that we feel when a very significant person is gone from our life. And all of these feelings that I will put up here will not necessarily be all of the feelings that a person might experience in grief. I'm just sort of giving you a general picture. And all of you have experienced grief in your life. And if this makes sense to you, I would like you to share that. And if it doesn't, I would also like you to say that. But from my own experience and from my experience with working with other people and what I have read, this seems to make sense to me. I respect loss a lot, but I get stuck in her stages, and I tend not to use the stages that she uses because it seems that if you look at grief in a form of stages, you think, well, now I'm over the denial stage, so I can push that behind, I can get on to the next stage, and when I'm done with that, I can just move on until I'm through with it. And what my experience has been with grief is that it's not that simple and concise and perfect. Grief, to me, seems more like moving 5 steps forward and 3 back, and 4 steps forward and 5 back. And it's much more of an up and down, round and round kind of emotional cycle that we go through. It's more helpful for me to think of it in that way. The model that I have used is a model by John Brantner. Who was a grief person in the Minneapolis area. He's no longer living, but this has made sense to me. He has he has sort of a triangle picture here. And this is kind of the major part. Starts out with shock, denial, and then we go through this whole emotional turmoil stage. And this swings back and forth, back and forth. You know, one day we're feeling okay, the next day not so okay. And finally we progress down into healing. This is kind of a natural grief process. Some people get stuck in this and it turns into kind of a pathological grief. But for most people, it's kind of this natural flow. What is icky about our society is that we give people like 2 days off for a funeral, and then we expect them to be back on the job that next week. And we're still in the shock stage at that point. Most grief takes at least a year, at least, if not 2, and maybe into the 3rd year. A grieving experience is a long, long time. And I think the hardest time for people is somewhere between the 5th to the 9th month. So, if you know people who have recently gone through a grief, they will be hurting deeply now, but there will be some kind of natural numbness that will carry them through for a while. and then that numbness will gradually start to melt away, and then you will feel some real intense pain. And oftentimes that happens from the 5th to the 9th month. When I was doing grief work, I tried to consistently contact people once or twice or 3 times within that period just to see how they were doing. What happens in our churches is that, you know, these widows who have lost a husband, we think by the 6th month they should be just fine, and this is probably the time that they really need some extra care. Also, times that are hard for people are times of birthdays and anniversaries and holidays of these folks that we have loved so deeply. Or maybe not have loved, too. I mean, we can also experience grief if the relationship has been real rocky, and sometimes it can be even worse then, because we have a lot of unresolved stuff. But if you think about your own grief experience, if you've had a traumatic one, the first thing, and shock and denial kind of come together at the same time. For example, if you would leave the village on Friday and call home and find out that someone that you really love has just died in a car accident, probably the first thing you would say is, no, it can't be true. I mean, no. And it's just like, that can't be true. Not this person that is so connected to me. So it's just basic denial. And then we go into the shock. And the shock is helpful because it's like getting Novocaine before a tooth is pulled. I mean, it kind of numbs the pain for a while. And it helps us get through it. Thank God for shock. Now you can see people walking around at the funeral, even smiling and being hospitable, because they're still probably so much in shock. Then after all the letters stop coming and the people stop calling, that's when the reality kind of starts to filter in. If we're going to put a time limit on it, I sort of hesitate to do this because it's not this concise, but I'll just give you some general ideas, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. But, I don't know, I've experienced significant losses within the past year, and I'm still kind of in denial about some of that stuff. I still can't believe it's true. And so that's just kind of a number to work with. Then this emotional turmoil. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff that goes on. One that's a big one for me is fear. I tried to touch on that some a little bit yesterday in the sermon. But C.S. Lewis says, I never knew that grief could feel so much like fear. I mean, you're just scared. You're scared about life. You're afraid to trust life again. Sometimes you're afraid of God. You're afraid that you're going to fail. You're afraid that somebody else that you love will die. Some widows and widowers that I have talked to are afraid, as this is the first time that they've lived alone for many, many years, they're afraid that their house is going to get broken into. Afraid that you can't make it on your own. You simply can't do it. So fear is a real, real common, even if it has nothing to do, or it seems like it has nothing to do with the loss, you just suddenly feel afraid of things that you didn't feel afraid of before. Well, it has to do with this emotional turmoil stage in grief. Another one that's real scary is anxiety, and that's more feeling afraid, but it's unfocused. You don't know what you're afraid of. I mean, you just sort of have these anxiety attacks. You know, your heart starts to beat real fast. You feel like you can't breathe, and you just got to get out of that room, like, immediately before it closes in on you. For those of you that have experienced that kind of anxiety, you know what that feels like. You're afraid, but you don't know what you're afraid of. Guilt. This is a good one for us in our culture. And I think that it has something to do with the fact that we think that we are in control of so many things. And the reality is, especially something like death, we're not in control of that. But we say things like, well, if only, you know, if only I would have taken him to the hospital sooner, if only I would have called 911, or if only I would have driven her to school, the car wouldn't have hit her, or if only I would have told her how much I loved her, you know, if only. If only, somehow we think that we ultimately could have kept that person from dying, and so we feel guilty about it. Or I had a man tell me recently, he said, I know why she died. She died because of what I did in World War II. This is God punishing me. You know, feeling guilt for her loss, that it was because of him. So that guilt is there, but it's not really helpful. I mean, it's a way of beating ourselves up, I guess. Depression is a part of this emotional turmoil stage. Feeling apathetic. You feel like you don't want to get out of bed in the morning. You feel like you don't care how you look. You don't want to wash your hair. You don't feel like cooking. You don't want to be with people. Well, you know what depression is like. We've all experienced it. Sometimes it's like this dark cloud that just seems to hover around us, and we can't get rid of it. We can't get out from underneath it. And what's real scary about depression for me, I remember when I first went through grief, was that I thought I would never get better again. I thought, now, for the rest of my life, I'm going to be depressed. This is really great. And so it sort of got into a feeling of despair, you know, and then you kind of think, well, is life worth living? I mean, who needs this? And what would have been helpful if someone would have said to me at that time, you know, there's healing. You're not always going to feel this. When you're in the midst of that, and especially if that lasts for 5 or 6 months, you think that you're never going to get better.
Sort of go on automatic pilot. And when I'm depression, a long time, everything was just, I was just doing it to get it done. And then going on to the next thing to get it done, and then it wasn't.
That's right, it's a good example of what it's like to be depressed. Another one is sadness. This is my favorite one because it just seems real healthy. You know, it just, if someone dies that you love, you just want to sit down and cry and cry and cry and cry. You're just plain sad. And it is so good to be able to release that through tears. It's like when my grandmother died, I didn't go through anxiety, fear, guilt, or any of that stuff. I just plain felt sad. And that was nice. And it just sort of went. And I still miss her. She died in 1970, but I'm not hung up on these other kinds of things. Let's see. Sometimes people feel relief for different reasons. Maybe the person has been suffering for a long time. Maybe he was a jerk and it was, you know, good to have him dead. I mean, some people, and then when he's dead and you feel relief, then you feel guilty for feeling relief. And I do know, I've talked to some people who have had a real awful relationship and didn't know how to get out of it, and so when the person died, relief was just kind of a natural feeling. There are oftentimes, I think, spiritual changes. And this is so intriguing to me. It seems like we either become closer to God or it feels like God has gone away somewhere, we don't know where. If you've read A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis, he describes it so well. He says, you know, when you're happy and you thank God and, you know, God's right there, but when you really need God, it sounds like a door is closed and bolted and double bolted, and then there's silence. And for some people in grief, it feels like God has totally disappeared. And you can see that in the Bible. If you read Psalm 88, for example, there's no rejoicing in God in that psalm. God, I've gone down in the pit, where are you? If you look at Job, if you look at Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? It feels like God is gone. But for others, and I've experienced both in different kinds of grief. Sometimes I felt like God has been, I mean, in Hong Kong, I thought God was gone. I mean, I thought God kind of loved everybody else and not me. I mean, it was real weird thinking, but I see now it was part of the grief. And then in other griefs that I've experienced, I have felt real close to God. And so, anyway, I oftentimes hear spiritual journey stories working with people in grief. Let's see. Anger. That's real typical too. You're angry at the doctor because the doctor didn't do what she was supposed to do. You're angry at the pastor because he is not there visiting you. You're angry at your friends because they're not calling you enough. You're angry at the car on the road ahead of you because they're not going fast enough. You're angry at the bank teller. You're angry. You're just plain angry. And real common emotion in grief, feeling tons of anger inside. Another thing that happens, and I don't know what to call it, so I'm not going to put it up here, I'm just going to tell you. It's in grief, in this emotional turmoil stage. It's when you feel like the person that you've lost, when you feel like that you can see him or hear him or smell him. And I think maybe this is where we get the idea of ghosts, maybe. This happens much more often than I ever knew about. I mean, I've heard tons of these stories. One woman said to me, I open up my linen closet and I see his face in the towels. One man said in our grief group, he said, I was lying upstairs in bed and I could smell the coffee percolating downstairs and I could hear her walking around down there. He said, I jumped out of bed and I ran down the steps and there was no coffee and she wasn't down there. People oftentimes have real vivid dreams of the person being okay. I've had such dreams myself working with hospice people. And usually those dreams are not frightening at all, but they are reassuring dreams. That you can so vividly see the person or hear them so clearly. It's like it's above and beyond a dream. It's almost like they're there. So that kind of stuff is real common in grief too. And then, physical changes. Our bodies are so connected to our souls and emotions, and it's real important, I think, that if you are going through grief that you take especially good care of your body. You know, try to eat 3 square meals a day. Try to exercise. Try to get plenty of sleep. Get a body massage. Take hot baths. Do anything that's going to nurture your body. The stress of grieving can be incredible. You can feel so, so tired. You can feel so drained. And we seem to be more accident prone during the grieving time. People come to our grief group with casts on, and it's real interesting. And they have car accidents, and they go and get a checkup 5 months later and find out they have cancer or an ulcer. Or not, you know, and I think there must be some relationship, some correlation to that. We need to be especially good to ourselves in grief. I'm going to stop there for a minute and see what your comments are. Has this been your experience, or?
I just want to underline the thing about there's no time limit. I lost a good friend of mine in high school. It was 20 years ago. I still go through waves of dealing with that. Mm-hmm. And when I first dealt with it emotionally, it was about 12 years after it happened. Mm-hmm. And it was tied up with not being able to cry, because I was trained not to cry. Mm-hmm. And when I did, it just poured out as if he had died yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it just... Vietnam vets is another example of that. They're still dealing with their losses, which are very great.
In my family, went into counseling for my brother's addiction. My grandmother went in, and there was a similar talk about this because of the grief you go through. And at the end, so wonderful, she went up and said, "I've been grieving since my son died when he was 8 years old by a drunk driver." And she's like in her middle 70s, and she's just now realizing she's still grieving. And it was, I recognized a long time ago, and my mom did, but she had got past the denial that she was grieving. So there is really is no time limit, 70 years.
It's hard to say who grieves more, or to compare griefs, but it's different. Because that could carry elements of hope. Maybe I can be friends with him, or maybe I can see him again. Or a lot of unresolved stuff. He's still walking around this world and doesn't want to have anything to do with me now, so a lot of anger stuff flows up. Whereas if a person dies, there's no hope at all. You never see them again in this life. Grieving might be different if we know that someone is going to die. Well, I know it's different. If we know that someone is going to die over again, someone who dies suddenly and unexpectedly, you still go through bereavement, but it's kind of different. And I don't know which one we could say would be worse. I know which one I would prefer, myself personally.
The other thing is that it really, it's not necessarily how close you are to the person. I was in a community where a woman committed suicide, and I was actually I was fairly close to her, and somehow it just didn't get me in a big way. And mostly I was really angry. But I didn't go through it nearly as much as I have with other losses. It just didn't seem to be that much. And there was a guy there that scarcely knew her. He's from Italy and had just come to the community a few months before. And he was just bowled over for months. It just touched something on him, that he needed to deal with.
Right.
It's really hard to say. I try to not feel bad that I didn't go through more. And we tried to make him feel okay that he had to go through a lot, even though he didn't know it that well.
Probably tapped a lot of unresolved grief stuff for him.
Right, the one up there that I can really relate to is depression. All the other stages seem to pale in comparison to getting into the depression state and finding no hope.
that despair that I'm never going to get out of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And having felt that, then watch somebody you love very dearly enter that same stage, mm-hmm. knowing that there's little to nothing that you can do.
That's right.
And I'm thinking more specifically of my brother right now, but that I just keep wondering, I keep asking questions. What can be done? What can be done? Mm-hmm. Looking and searching, and what can you do? And I keep coming up empty.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on this before? We've got about 10 minutes to go here, 5. Maybe we should get into the healing, as long as what can be done, what can we do?
And also if we can, it's appropriate to think particularly about Jeff, you know, where he'll be and how we can be there for him.
Okay.
Do you have any, is there, I don't know if there's any difference or of dealing with, like double loss. My mom, this last about a year ago, more than a year ago. My dad's dad died on Thursday, and my mom's mom died on Friday. Mm-hmm. And one was completely unexpected, and another one was somewhat. I just remember, you know, going back from the two places that they live and trying to struggle at even who you were grieving for at the different funerals.
And that's a real good question, and it is real hard to separate who you're grieving for. And I've seen that especially with some of these older folks. If one dies, like somebody in their late 80s or something, if one of them dies, the other one oftentimes, it seems, dies of a broken heart. And so here you've got these adult children trying to deal with two real close deaths. And all I can say is it's twice as hard. I mean, it's tough. It's real tough. But then you don't have to ruin 2 years of your life in grief. You can just do it all in one. No, I'm just kidding.
Probably takes it twice as long.
I don't have any solid answers for any of this stuff. You know, one thing I want to say about this too is that this stuff does not go through in stages. I mean, once you felt depressed and then you're out of it and you start feeling some anxiety, well, which can be real related. Let's say you start feeling some sadness instead of depression. That doesn't mean that your depression is necessarily over forever. That means that you might go back into it again, or you might go into some anger and then go back into feeling some fear and back and forth. And then one day you might wake up and you might think, wow, I feel kind of happy today. And I remember the first time I felt happiness again, it was like, oh, this feels good. I forgot how good that this feels, you know. And then you think, oh, good, I'm all healed. And then 3 days later, you hear a song on the radio that reminds you of that person again, and then you're right back into it again. So what I'm trying to say is that it's all kind of mixed up feelings.
The struggle that I've always had is dealing with, you know, helping people through grief who don't have any faith. In my own situation, my mom died 10 years ago, and my sister isn't very Christian in her perspective. And that's where I was able to work through it that way. But I think I grieve more for my sister than my mother. She just couldn't deal with
it. And you think it was because she didn't have faith in God?
I guess I would think that was certainly part of it. She didn't know where to turn. But mm-hmm. There was no solace.
It is hard to watch someone struggle who doesn't have a base of peace, wherever, you know, wherever that might be, whether it's in their God or themselves or It's hard to watch them with that struggle. You can't... as far as faith stuff goes, I want to say that when I was grieving the first time, when people would quote Bible passages to me, it was not helpful for me to hear that. It just didn't work, you know. And I didn't care if she was with Jesus in heaven. That didn't mean two hoots to me at that point. But at other times, that kind of faith statement may have helped. And so to be sensitive about where people are at in their faith journey, I think. I've drawn a ball of grief here that kind of hangs over our heads, and I think what happens is that here we are. Well, and what we need to do is turn around and face it and just dive right through it. And the reason why I do a lot of grieving stuff with people is because I'm really bad at it myself, and I keep trying to learn how to do it better. And I don't do grieving very well. I know all kinds of ways of how to avoid it, and I do the circle around, or I try to run away from it oftentimes, you know. But the thing is that it will follow you until you can turn around and face it and dive through it and go right through the center. And sometimes that means, oftentimes that means talking and talking and talking and talking about it with someone. I mean, people who are grieving need to talk about it. When Jeff comes back, he will need to talk about it again and again and again and again. I mean, I'm assuming that. I'm thinking that. you need to know that person was valued. You all, I mean, can't make that assumption, but many of you here knew her, knew Joyce, and so for you to be able to reflect your memories about her would be real helpful for him to know that her existence was real important. And not just now, but a year from now and 2 years from now, to keep talking about her. We gotta talk about it. And cry. I'm going to put that up. But any kind of emotion that needs to be expressed should get out. If you're angry at God, allow the person to be angry at God. Don't try to protect God. You know, just, you know, let it be expressed to encourage the crying. We're real embarrassed about crying, and it's unfortunate because if we, you know, we stuff it down, stuff it down, stuff it down, pretty soon it feels like we're choking. I mean, you can actually feel it. And just to let it go, and what a release. A person who is newly grieving, if you're really a doer, you can do things for them, like bring them hot dishes, or clean their room, or if they want that, or help make choices about funerals, or, you know, do some of this, or help them get the death certificates, or do some basic 1-2-3s. And this, you know, if you're a doer, then step in within the first 2 or 3 weeks. But if you're more of a beer, that's the time then to enter in maybe 3 weeks later, or when Jeff comes up here, to be with him, just to simply to listen to him. There's no way that you can take his grief away from him. There's no way you can take your depression, Dave, your brother's depression, away from him. There's no way you can do that. But we each have to go through this stuff by ourselves. And it can be a real lonely journey. But there's no way you can do it for someone else. And although we want to, if you dive into the pit with them, then you too can become depressed. But that's not going to take it away from them. Then we've got two depressed people instead of one. But to be there and to embrace them. And this is not to say that you shouldn't be empathetic, because we need to be. Sometimes it's hard to feel empathy for a person in grief if you haven't experienced it yourself. But if you have, then you can be very present for them. We do a lot of avoidance in our culture by drinking too much, any kind of substance abuse, perhaps eating too much. We do a lot of shopping. We fill ourselves up with a lot of people. We, and a good one Yes, working too much. I call people up and say, how are things going? Oh, I'm just so busy, I don't even have time to think about it. And I think, oh, brother. Well, so that means that I'm going to have to keep, you know, keep in touch with them for a long time until they finally sit down and relax and start thinking about it. Because there's a lot of avoidance stuff that can go on because it can be so painful to sit down and turn around and face it.
I just want to throw something in. One, I think one thing we have to kind of unlearn about how to deal with people who experience loss is, I guess, it's kind of manner or face or something. I mean, we're taught that sort of, you know, this showing a deep concern and worry on our faces, it is sort of the stereotype of how to be with somebody. And it's, and it is kind of a natural response. It's a way to show that you really care. Mm-hmm. But it can actually not be the best way to be around somebody because it kind of makes them feel like, oh, me going through my grieving process is being really hard for this person or something. Or it can, yeah. I just think a kind of a neutral, very listening kind of way to be, you know, kind of relaxed and calm is actually more useful to somebody. It's kind of being with them.
I think that's part of the listening skills, being able to hear where they're at, you know, what's and surrounding them wherever that is. You know, if they need to be sad, then maybe you can be sad too.
And
or a sense of humor is real important too.
Yeah.
If you know. You know Jeff, and you know if that would be appropriate for him, but I find it real healing for myself.
And also that it'll bring up feelings in us. Being around somebody going through that
right.
touches it off in us, and we may need to spend some time with ourselves, not with Jeff, processing our own grief.
I also think to treat anyone in grief very naturally, you know, don't avoid. Sometimes people who are grieving in churches are avoided by folks because nobody knows what to say to them, so they just sort of, you know, off they go. But to be with him normally. It also might be inappropriate if you haven't been good friends with Jeff to suddenly become his best buddy. I mean, he might not even want that, you know, and to respect that space too. But to, you know, to definitely express a concern or love. Yes.
A question. What about people who are just compulsive yakkers after something difficult? I mean, not talking therapeutically, but just chattering on and on about this and that and the other thing and never saying anything real. What's your response to that?
You mean they're not talking about grief, but they're just...
They're not, right. They're just yakking on and on about, you know, what was on TV that day or... Just kind of using talking as a drug. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's a good question.
I found that a lot as a nurse. That
it is an avoidance thing, I think.
It's a definite avoidance
thing. Isn't that denial? But sometimes, you know, I'm thinking of being with people who have cancer. For example, I remember when I was first a chaplain, I thought, okay, now they have to face this and they have to face reality. But now I think that that's not so smart because I think maybe they just need to talk about normal everyday life things. Maybe that's their way of feeling like they are part of the normal world. I try to get my signals from them. I'm not... If it is a drug, maybe they need that drug for a while. If this is consistent for a year, I would say, I'm really tired of listening to this. And I wouldn't say that in those words. But I would say, I'm really wondering, I know your mom died 4 months ago, I'm really wondering how you are with that. I might just make that a direct statement. But I think sometimes people need to avoid. And I'm especially compassionate about that when I'm with people who are sick or who are dying. I take my clues from them. Any other?
Physical contact. If somebody's really stuck, sometimes just, you know, if you have a sort of relationship where you can put your arm around them or something, even if they're talking about the coffee or something, it can
sometimes hurt too.
And that, you know, that too, to take your clues from them. Some people find that real helpful. And a touch can, for me, sometimes can set off some tears. If someone says to me, you look, you seem so sad, and they'll put their arm around me, well, I can just start crying right there, you know. But you need to know who you're with too. Some people don't want that at all. So it's a real kind of perceptive, sensitive, fine line that you walk. And we make mistakes. You know, we just do. And so you goof and then you go on. Our time is up. If you want to stay after, if you want to continue to talk about it, but if you need to go, please feel free to do that.
Thanks.